Hello, my name's Dave Emery. This is For the Record program 212. In this half-hour segment, we're going to be talking about a Nazi tract called Serpent's Walk. That's a book that I've discussed at considerable length in the past and in numerous programs. In For the Record program number 90, I analyzed and reviewed Serpent's Walk, and that's available from Spitfire. Serpent's Walk is a Nazi tract, purportedly a novel, authored by someone who writes under the name of Randolph D. Calverhall, last name C-A-L-V-E-R-H-A-L-L. The book was published in softcover by National Vanguard Books. It's copyright 1991, ISBN number 0-93794-944-05-X. This book, again, is published by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, arguably the most important of the domestic Nazi groups. And National Vanguard Books published the Turner Diaries, authored by William Luther Pierce, the head of the National Alliance. I believe that just like the Turner Diaries, which was the blueprint or role model for the Nazi group The Order, which took its name from the Turner Diaries in the mid-1980s, as well as for Timothy McVeigh and company, the book Serpent's Walk, I believe, to be much more than the novel it purports to be. I think it's a manifesto and a blueprint for what Nazi and fascist elements, including and especially what I call the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich gone underground, have done and are planning to do. The book Serpent's Walk is about a Nazi takeover in the mid-21st century by the descendants of the SS who go underground, build up their economic power, buy into the American opinion-forming media, infiltrate the U.S. Army and military, and after a biological warfare attack by genetically engineered microorganisms, apparently involving the genetic engineering technique of what's known as gene therapy, using a virus to introduce genetic material into cells, this plague then kills much of the world's population, including the vice president and president of the United States. And then the Nazi group takes over, the Party of Humankind, the front group for the Underground Reich, then takes over the world. The book Serpent's Walk's back cover reads as follows. The good guys win sometimes. Not always, of course. They lost big in the Second World War. That war was a victory for communists, Democrats, and Jews, but everyone else lost, including millions of GIs who were told that they were killing Germans and Japanese in order to make the world a decent place for their children to grow up, only to see things in America go from bad to much, much worse in the decades after the war. Even when the bad guys win, they sometimes grow careless and later become losers. Look what happened to the communists of Eastern Europe in the 1990s. Could the same thing happen to their erstwhile World War II allies in America? Serpent's Walk explores that possibility. It assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and, quote, equality, unquote. I would note that the SS takeover of the United States takes place again after a biological warfare attack by genetically engineered microorganisms ostensibly of Soviet origin, bear in mind this was written in 1991, are unleashed on the world. And the two fictional microorganisms here are called Pakov and Starak. Starak is spelled capital S-T-A-R-A-K, and Pakov is P-A-C-O-V. And in this book, the U.S., according to the, again, this is a novel, although I believe it's a blueprint, genetically engineered a Pakov virus, P-A-C-O-V, and this apparently was genetically engineered and adapted to kill certain types of ethnic people. And this was originally unleashed on the former Soviet Union and on parts of Asia, and then the Soviet Union retaliated with the Starak organism. And bear in mind that there's no Soviet Union anymore, of course, but we are hearing a great deal about former Soviet biological warfare weapons that are or are allegedly turning up in the hands of, internet quote, international terrorists, unquote. Of the biological warfare attack that presages the Nazi takeover, we read in Serpent's Walk, this is the they here is the Underground Reich. The news they had picked up in Seattle was bad. Many of the great eastern cities were dead or dying. Houston and Dallas had been infected with a ghastly bacteria-borne botulin-like poisoning. Similar outbreaks were now being reported in Cleveland and Cincinnati and Pittsburgh and Boston and Portland and Salt Lake City and Miami and a dozen other places. The nation was being held together only by the most desperate measures imposed by frantic police, National Guard units, and the military. In Detroit, the FBI nabbed a man in the very act of emptying a vial of bacterial broth into a reservoir. The man swallowed the stuff and then leaped into the water anyway. Detroit was now off limits to anybody not wearing an NBC, a nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare suit. The Army estimated nearly a million deaths in Detroit already. The toxin was delivered through the water supply, but it killed more than just those who drank it, and those who came into too close contact with the drinkers as they vomited and coughed their lives away. Wherever it collected, in holding tanks and sewers, it fumed and bubbled and emitted bacteria-laden mists. When a fire set off a sprinkler system in a discount store in Cleveland, 1,000 people died. It was the same all over. Russia's science had been almost as thorough as America's in the megadeath department. New York, Chicago, and Washington were cemeteries. Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, Denver, and certain other cities had so far escaped. Perhaps the enemy's distribution system had failed on the West Coast. Perhaps it was just slower, and death was still on his way. Pakov had dealt Russia and Asia a grand slam home run blow. The Russians had come right back in the next inning with Starock, however, and it looked like a rally for their team. The series was still up for grabs. Who was spreading the toxins? The carriers were entering the United States along the drug routes, the Miami and the Gulf Coast, the Canadian border, and the deserts of the Southwest. And I would note in this book, again, this purports to be a novel. I believe it's far more than that. I believe it's a blueprint, though not necessarily literal in all of its respects. Let me stress about this particular broadcast that this program obviously is speculative in nature. I'm not stating these things are. I'm asking, are they? And not only with regard to Serpent's Walk, but with regard to many other things in this program, this is speculative, and I want to underline that emphatically. I'm attempting to look into the crystal ball and analyze things going on now because the possible implications of these things couldn't be exaggerated. The next discussion here is one between, in Serpent's Walk, between Lessing, a mercenary who ultimately gets converted to the Nazi cause, and a black American Muslim named Khalifa, who is acting in concert with the Underground Reich, and he's talking about establishing a black homeland for African Americans in Africa. I suspect that the role model for this might be Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam. That, however, is speculative. Turning to the book Serpent's Walk, we read, and note again that Pakov was genetically engineered, and note also that the virus was that the organism was piggybacked onto other viruses. This is obviously a reference to a type of genetic engineering called gene therapy, in which a virus can be used to introduce genetic material into cells. That could be used, obviously, for therapeutic reasons. It also can be used for anything but therapeutic reasons, as is the case in this, quote, hypothetical, unquote, situation. And note that this particular variation of Pakov was genetically engineered, but note the reference to gene therapy, or piggybacking an organism on a virus, in order to introduce genetic material into cells. Continuing. Black Pakov, Lessing exploded, and Morgan echoed him, suicide, speaking of the Khalifa's plan to move black African-Americans to Africa. The Khalifa then replies, quote, nice of you to be concerned. Let me tell you something about Pakov if you don't know it already. The two original Pakov piggyback viruses have active lives of less than 2 months, important for a weapon of war. The mutant strains are less stable. They last longer, and they may flare up several times before quitting for good, but they do die out. Give Pakov 4 months. The time we'll need to get ready, and there'll be no major populations alive in the affected regions of Africa. So again, note the reference here to gene therapy and to using microorganisms to introduce, using viruses to piggyback, unquote, and to, or in a piggyback fashion, and in order to introduce genetic material into cells of the person infected. In numerous programs, including For the Record segments 198 and 199, we've dealt with the SV40, or simian virus 40. That's a cancer-causing monkey virus that infected the original polio vaccine and has also infected other vaccines. We spoke about this in connection with Ed Haslam, the heroic author of the vitally important recent book Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, story of an underground medical laboratory published in softcover by Wordsworth Press, copyright 1995. In For the Record program 198, we visited with Ed Haslam and discussed a consummately important article from the Atlantic Monthly's issue of February of the year 2000. This article is headlined, or entitled, I should say, The Virus and the Vaccine, subtitled authored, I should say, by Debbie Bookchin, B-O-O-K-C-H-I-N, and Jim Schumacher, S-C-H-U-M-A-C-H-E-R. In this article, or this article, I should say, is about the SV40, a cancer-causing monkey virus, which, again, has contaminated numerous vaccines. And the article is the focal point of the discussion of 198, the major focal point, anyway, of the discussion in For the Record program 198, an interview with Ed Haslam, and also the focal point of For the Record program 199, a reading of this article. The Atlantic Monthly's website has this article on it. I believe, acting from memory, that that is at Atlantic Monthly, atlanticmonthly.com, but you can certainly look it up on the Internet. Now, in this article, there is discussion of the SV40, and specifically Michele Carbone's work on SV40. He's a brilliant and heroic Italian researcher who has, in many ways, led the medical community's inquiries into the SV40. He has been actively frustrated in his efforts by elements of the National Cancer Institute and the Center for Disease Control. Of the SV40, Michele Carbone says in this particular article, skipping down, SV40 is the smallest perfect war machine ever, unquote, Carbone murmurs, again quoting, he's so small, but he's got everything he needs, unquote. Skipping down, the virus consists of six proteins, three of which make up the 20-sided triangular scaffolding that is the virus's protein skin. But one of the remaining proteins, called large T antigen for tumor antigen, unquote, is, according to Carbone, the most oncogenic protein ever discovered. It is unique, he says, in its ability to cause cancer when it is set loose inside a cell. In 1997, in Nature Medicine, Carbone published the first in a series of papers that outlined how large T antigen blocks crucial tumor-suppressing pathways in human mesothelial cells. Whenever a cell begins to divide in the process known as mitosis, a small number of quality control agents goes to work. Running up and down the cell's DNA, these genes and proteins work together to scrutinize the DNA's integrity. If at any stage of cell division they detect DNA abnormalities, they cannot be repaired. If at any stage of cell division they detect DNA abnormalities that cannot be repaired, mitosis is halted, and the cell undergoes apoptosis, or cellular suicide. The principle in this elaborate regulatory dance is a gene called P53. Arnold Levine, the president of the Rockefeller University in New York and the discoverer of P53, says that 60% of all cancers involve some sort of P53 damage, mutation, or inactivation. Again, quoting, the P53 gene is central to human cancers, unquote, he says, describing it as, again quoting, the first line of defense against cancer formation, unquote. I would note, as we looked at in For the Record programs 198 and 199, deactivating the P53 gene is just one of the ways in which large T antigen, the most carcinogenic protein ever discovered, or oncogenic protein ever discovered, causes cancer. And again, note that one of the central ways it operates is by decommissioning the P53 gene, which guards against chromosomal damage during cellular reproduction. And according to Arnold Levine, who discovered the gene, it figures in 60 damage to the P53 gene, or abnormalities in it, figures in 60% of cancers. Now, again, let me stress emphatically that this program is speculative in nature. Let me also reinforce something I've stressed in the past. I am not a medical or scientific or biotech expert. Nonetheless, I can think and I can add two and two and come up with four. And I find a number of things very disturbing about an article that I read the day after I recorded For the Record programs 198 and 199. Now, bear in mind, in the supposedly fictional book Serpent's Walk, which I believe to be a blueprint for the future, the technique of piggybacking genetically engineered and highly toxic microorganisms onto the back of viruses was discussed, and that figures in the bio-war scenario that ultimately leads to the declaration of martial law and the coming to power of the Party of Humankind, the underground Reich's front group in that book. Bear in mind that that piggybacking is one of the elements that figures, obviously, in that biowarfare attack. The following article is from the San Francisco Chronicle's Business and Technology section from Monday, March 6th of the year 2000. This is an article by Tom Abate, A-B-A-T-E or Abate, I'm not sure how it's pronounced. It's headlined, A Thank You to the Volunteers Who Step Up for Clinical Trials, subtitled Experimental Trials Offer Last Chance When Other Treatments Fail. Bear in mind what Michele Carbone talked about with the SV-40 being the smallest perfect war machine ever. I wonder whether perhaps there was more truth to that than he really understood at the time. I would also note in this context that SV-40 can be passed through sexual contact. It's present in semen. It also can be apparently passed from mothers to their children, perhaps through breast milk or perhaps in utero somehow. I would also note that it appears to be behind, among other cancers, an epidemic of soft tissue cancers, including lymphoma and cancers of the breast and prostate. The connection between semen and the prostate and breast milk and or mother's milk and the breast, obviously, need not be elaborated on under the circumstances. I would also note this following element in the Tom Abate article. I remember that, and this, by the way, is to a certain extent peripheral, but is interesting to contemplate. We're going to get to the main aspect of this article. I remember the day my friend Joanne told me she had breast cancer. She was chopping carrots in her kitchen when she mentioned it matter-of-factly, brushing the carrots off the cutting board into the salad. That was years ago. Doctors treated her cancer aggressively, and thankfully it hasn't returned. My mother, mother-in-law, and several close friends could tell the same story. One wonders how many people have either caught this from someone that they've had sexual relations with, or perhaps from their mother or somebody else. It again, is a highly communicative virus. And the main part of this article, that again is kind of peripheral, perhaps even apocryphal, but one of the things that caught my attention in reading this article was a discussion of the P53 gene, and if one, say, were the underground Reich, and if one wished to decimate the population of the United States, one wouldn't necessarily have to do it with a very fast-acting genetically engineered organism. If one, for example, filled the environment with very potent carcinogens, and then were to inactivate the body's defenses against cancer, ultimately the immune system, which has many ways of guarding against cancer, many of those undermined, as we looked at in For the Record programs 198 and 199, by SV40 and the large T antigen, then one could affect the sort of decimation of the population that would ultimately not only reduce the United States bring the United States to its knees, but could ultimately lead to the Serpent's Walk scenario, albeit in a much, much slower fashion. Again, I'm not suggesting that Serpent's Walk is to be taken absolutely literally in every respect, but I do think it's a blueprint. Skipping down, there is discussion of the P53 gene in this article, and in addition to the SV40, the P53 gene is inactivated, at least for a period of time, by the adenovirus which causes the common cold. And apparently, the adenovirus is now the focal point of genetic engineering. Reading from the Chronicle again of Monday, March 6th of the year 2000, Frank McCormick, a biotech researcher since the early days of Cetus Corporation, was toiling away at Chiron in the early 1990s when he had the brainstorm that led him to form Richmond's Onyx. His idea revolved around a gene known as P53. Think of P53 as the judge, jury, and executioner of wayward cells. If a cell begins to mutate and grow in a cancerous fashion, P53 is supposed to kill it. Since the late 1970s, scientists have known that successful cancers somehow manage to inactivate P53. Cancers aren't the only bad actors that turn off this cellular self-destruct system. Since the 1980s, scientists have known that adenovirus, the bug that causes colds, also deactivates P53. When adenovirus invades a cell, it turns off P53, then inserts itself into the cell's DNA. The virus uses the cell's reproductive machinery to produce so many copies of itself that it eventually explodes the cell from the inside out, showering the body with new viral particles to infect other cells. All that was old hat. Well, again, one of the things that this makes me wonder about is if it is possible there is then discussion of using a genetically engineered adenovirus to destroy cancer cells. I wonder if it would be possible perhaps to piggyback or genetically engineer an adenovirus in such a way as to inject material into cells in order to produce cancer, sort of a negative scenario of the one presented here. By the way, this should not be misunderstood as impugning in any way Mr. McCormick or his corporation. I simply did not realize that the P53 gene was also deactivated by the adenovirus, and I wonder whether perhaps that virus or some other virus could be genetically engineered to piggyback in a cancer-causing organism that could bring about a slow-motion serpent's walk scenario. One of the things that we looked at in a miscellaneous archive show entitled Sons of the Gestapo was an assertion by former SS officer Karl Wolff, last name W-O-L-F-F, Himmler's personal adjutant and at one point the number two man in the SS, that there was a whole new generation of SS that had been raised up and were operating in secret around the world. That is one of the things that I refer to when I talk about the Underground Reich, although there's firmer evidence than what Karl Wolff talked about in the book Quest, co-authored by Ib Melchior and Frank Brandenburg, softcover Presidio Press, copyright 1990. I wonder about the presence of a second generation of SS, as talked about in Serpent's Walk, and where they might be and what they might be doing. We're going to turn now to the book Emerging Viruses, subtitled AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional, published in hardcover by Tetrahedron Press and authored by Dr. Leonard Horowitz, whom we've spoken about before. Under Project Paperclip, a project under which Nazi researchers and their work were brought into the United States, there's discussion of the importation of Eric Traub and his assistant Anna Burger, who was in charge of biological warfare for the Third Reich. They were brought into the United States and went to work for, among other institutions, the Naval Biomedical Research Laboratory associated with the National Cancer Institute that we've spoken about in numerous programs in connection with the probable genetically engineered biological warfare origins of AIDS. Turning to emerging viruses, we read, Eric Traub, for instance, in charge of biological warfare for the Reich Research Institute on the secluded island of Reims, that's how it's spelled, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, where his biological warfare research specialty was viral and bacteriological diseases, unquote, and his assistant Anna Burger went to work for the Navy in 1951 under Project Paperclip. Assigned to the Naval Medical Research Institute Laboratory in Bethesda, their work, quote, included conducting experiments on animals to determine the lethal doses of more than 40 strains of highly infectious viruses. Within 10 years, the Navy's Biomedical Research Laboratory, or NBRL, along with Litton Bionetics, had become a chief supplier of, quote, cell cultures for cancer research studies to National Cancer Institute investigators, unquote, throughout the world. And there's a supplemental discussion linking these institutions with the National Cancer Institute. And again, in that context, I wonder how many second-generation SS might be present. Note the following article from the New York Times of January 10th of the year 2000. This is an article by Eric Pace. It's entitled Hans Schwerte, 90, Ex-SS Man Who Hid Identity. This article reads in part as follows. Hans Schwerte, an authority on literary history who admitted in 1995 that under another name he had been an SS officer, died on December 18th in a retirement home in Markarstein, Germany. He was 90. His death was announced by the Aachen Technical University. By the time he acknowledged his SS role under his original name, Hans Ernst Schneider, Dr. Schwerte had retired as a professor at the university where he was rector from 1970 to 1973 and had received a high German decoration for his post-war contributions to German scholarship. Skipping down. In 1995, he gave an interview to a reporter for the New York Times at a time when he had been accused of having helped to produce medical equipment, microscopes, centrifuges, and crucibles used for so-called scientific experiments in the Dachau camp. As Hans Ernst Schneider, records indicated, he was also on the personal staff of Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, and the Gestapo. Skipping down. After Dr. Schwerte had acknowledged his SS role, Simon Wiesenthal, the Nazi hunter who had made fruitless inquiries about his past, said in an interview, quote, "There are many Schwertes in other fields, but the fact that he could become the rector of a university is unique," unquote. Well, I wonder whether that's actually unique or whether there are more second generation SS in positions of influence within the U.S. medical and scientific establishments and elsewhere. In that context, and again speculatively, note the following two articles, both from the San Jose Mercury News. This is from the Mercury News of Friday, March 10th of the year 2000. It's an AP story by Chelsea J. Carter, headlined, "Neighbors Forced Out of Their Homes in Conspiracy Probe," and it reads in part as follows. A botched hit, a suicide, and now the evacuation of a neighborhood. The probe of a failed murder conspiracy that investigators say has gone from, quote, strange to bizarre, unquote, forced neighbors of a dead medical researcher out of their homes this week because of fears he may have hidden chemicals in his backyard. "I have never seen anything this bizarre. Every day it's something new," unquote, Police Lieutenant Sam Alavato said Thursday. Nearly 2 weeks ago, a masked gunman attacked BioFem Pharmaceutical and Company Chief James Patrick Riley in the company parking lot. The gunman fired once, hitting Riley in the face. He was hospitalized for 5 days and then released. Almost immediately, police focused on Riley's business partner, Dr. Larry C. Ford, a medical researcher. The two men were trying to market a vaginal suppository to combat AIDS transmission and believed the product would make millions of dollars. But before police could question Ford, he committed suicide. Police have since arrested Ford's longtime friend, Dino DeSax, 56, of Altadena, as the suspected getaway driver in the shooting of Riley. Police continue to search for the gunman. On Thursday, county fire officials said the FBI's hazardous material and bomb squad found 3 canisters of unidentified liquid buried in Ford's backyard, Alavato said. A search of the house yielded thousands of rounds of rifle ammunition between a trap door, he said. And again noting the following, this is from the San Jose Mercury News of Saturday, March 11th of the year 2000, the following day. And this is an AP story datelined Irvine, headlined, "Doctor allegedly linked to CIA, and weapons program," unquote. And of Mr. Ford discussed in that article, the article reads, working down, "Ford worked on chemical weapons for the government and advised the South African government on how to protect military personnel against biological attacks," the Los Angeles Times reported Friday. "He worked with the Central Intelligence Agency for 20 years, Card said. That's his lawyer, Brian Card. Adding that not even Ford's wife knew much about that. Although the extent of Ford's involvement with the South African military is unclear, Dr. Otto Mueller, M-U-L-L-E-R, a medical researcher, told the Times that Ford confided to him that he was involved in military-led programs to develop biological weapons. What I call food for thought and grounds for further research. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.